You're listening to Federal Prison Authority Presents Around the Block with Bruce Cameron and Susan Giddings, only on LA Talk Radio.
All right. Great music, isn't it, folks? It's wonderful.
Hey, how are you doing today?
Great decision we jointly made on our credits. So, well, hello, everybody. Welcome again to Around the Block, Federal Prison Authority Presents Around the Block with myself, Bruce Cameron, and Susan Giddings. Good afternoon, Susan.
Hey, how you doing?
Good. Well, before we get, we just have so much to talk about today, but keeping to my promise, today is brought to you by FCI Latuna. They're a sponsor. Look at that pretty cup. FCI Latuna, folks, I was there about once or twice a year for about 11 years. And an RDAP program there, big RDAP program, as a matter of fact, back in the day, it was huge, right? It's huge. I was doing pre-release there, Susan, and I would just have football fields of inmates to tell them what to do once they got in the RRC. So shout out to Latuna. You know, interesting. Part of it is in Anthony, New Mexico, and part of it is in Texas. So it's right there on the state line. I don't know how they figured that out, but they did. Well, without further ado, we're going to talk about, again, one of our favorite topics and almost the reason of the season, is First Step Act along with Second Chance Act. So many questions. You guys have so many questions on our Facebook group, which is First Step Act Early Release from Federal Prison. Thank you for joining our community. We're just about to 10,000 members. And, man, that's just been quite a group that I opened up in COVID, and it was a CARES Act group that I renamed it to where we are today with what's going on with releases. So, Dr. Giddings, you know, First Step Act and Second Chance Act, yet again, and I'm going to get a sanitized computation, you know, I got some mail in here, if you know what I mean, and sanitize and show people some of these credit sheets, right? And but the First Step Act and the Second Chance Act. First Step Act, Second Chance Act. A lot of confusion. You know, it's just crazy. So I guess what I'll do is I'll open it to you, Susan. What is the most commonly the misconception that we see about, let's say, FCA versus SCA?
Sure. Sure. Well, first off, you know, it does confuse people that the Second Chance Act actually happened before the First Step Act. Just kind of a quirky little naming issue there. But, you know, one of the big issues is the issue of Bureau discretion. That is the huge issue. And that issue, which, you know, you and I have talked about, they created problems when they didn't kind of fully reconcile the Second Chance Act when they wrote the First Step Act, right? They just weren't thinking back to go, well, what did we do back then, right? So, but the reality is the Second Chance Act the Bureau has 100% discretion on how they place an individual. You know, process-wise, the unit team makes a recommendation, it goes to the warden either concurs with the recommendation or doesn't, but once he concurs or she concurs with that recommendation, it goes off to the residential reentry office, and then under the five-factor review, community resources comes into play. And community resources is everything from bed space, monitoring equipment, staffing at the halfway house, Bureau budget, all of that falls into play. And based on that, the residential reentry folks can either place as recommended, reduce the recommendation, or deny that recommendation altogether. They can do direct home confinement if the person's eligible. They can do halfway house followed by direct home confinement at a later point. It is wide open and the Bureau's discretion. And because of that, and because of the scope and purpose of the Second Chance Act, which is transitional reentry services, the Bureau will opt for a shorter house placement if it means keeping the individual closer to home. Why? Because it's home. you know, what good does it do somebody to get a job, work it for a few weeks, couple of months, 500 miles from your home, and then come back and start over? Like, the whole point is transition. So they will opt to shorten a placement to keep you close by rather than put you further away for maybe a month to more.
But I believe, raise my hand. Yes, Bruce. Yes, ma'am. I believe we had a situation where the releasing inmate had a long enough sentence that their FSA time put them in, they were from Houston, put them in Brownsville, Texas, because of the FSA time, not because of the Second Chance Act being close to home stuff, right?
Yes and no. So that individual was on a Second Chance Act placement, but because of First Step Act placements taking priority, the only placing available at that time would put that person down in Brownsville. And of course,
because of bed space.
Work to get them transferred to Houston when a space came open because, you know, somebody got in trouble and lost their bed. So now a bed got open.
Right. So if there's, but in that case, the Second Chance, no, the First Step Act drove the length of time. I mean, more or less, right? Didn't have,
well,
because all their sentence went toward FSA.
All of their sentence went to FSA to shorten the sentence. All of their halfway house time was under the Second Chance Act. But because of other First Step Act placements, because under the current interpretation of the First Step Act, the Bureau does not have that extensive discretion. Bed space was filling up and that person got bumped.
Gotcha.
They still gave them halfway house. They opted to give them some halfway house. I was actually kind of surprised, given the length of sentence and everything else, that they opted to put them in Brownsville and didn't just deny the placement altogether.
Right.
I mean, so, if you had asked me to place a bet on it, I would have said they were going to get denied.
Right. At least they got
something. Yeah.
And so, and we've had clients recently get placements and dates. And so I know it's probably not the time to bring this up, but let's think of the broader context, which is, you know, bed space and then funding for bed space. Now, folks, all this stuff, all this politicized stuff, which is true because the BOP it's an organization that's run by politicians. Make no mistake about it. I mean, whatever. I mean, that congressional interview should have been sobering for some of you folks that got to see that, to show, you know, what's in the minds of decision makers and politicians that are above the director of the Bureau of Prisons. That said, now we're talking about funding, right? Funding, and there's no funding in that. The BOP has been operating under a continuing resolution for a long time, folks. CR, continuing resolution. And that means that, you know, that's not a budget. And so the continuing resolution that the Bureau of Prisons is operating under today might be, is it 2023 or 2024 levels of funding?
Officially, it's 2024 because late in FY24, they finally passed the budget. But most of FY24 was funded on a CR, which was based on FY23. So even when they finally got funded at the end of 24, the full impact wasn't felt because what they were doing was honestly running at a deficit, you know, as they were placing people in. And of course, the big blow up with the budget in terms of reentry was it was in October. So FY25, which the Bureau doesn't have a budget for, and they are talking about a continuing resolution right now to the end of the fiscal year, which means they will maintain at the FY24 levels. But what wasn't happening in 24 and is happening in 2025 was mid-October, and of course October 1 is the new fiscal year, mid-October the Bureau rolled out the FSA conditional placement calculator. And that placement calculator pulled a whole bunch of folks who weren't even on the radar for Halfway House into the Halfway House group that people were looking at, that case managers are trying to refer. And that flipped the budget on its head. Because when the Bureau is looking at the budgets, and I did this as a case management coordinator back several years ago, I could run my release roster. I could see how many people were going to definitely release between now and the end of the fiscal year. I could see how many could get half the house, right? Because they could get up to 6 months of, you know, realistically, I was at a more secure facility. You didn't see a whole lot of longer placements. So realistically, I counted anybody who had a release date 6 months into the new fiscal year that they could get a halfway house date. And then for good measure, I added 10% on that just in case, because you just never know what's going to happen in terms of sentencing reductions or new individuals with short sentences. So I could predict what my budget was going to be. Now, imagine that I've done my budget estimates, and now this new calculator rolls out. Now I'm not just running my release date roster and 6 months past that, I'm having to run my conditional release roster. And now I'm running my conditional placement roster, which is pulling in individuals whose release dates right now could be more than 2 years out.
Yeah.
So when we're talking about running a roster for the next fiscal year, okay, which for at the institution level actually starts early, much earlier on, you know, I started running my rosters to calculate my release roster this time of the year for next year, you know, in January, February time period. So I was looking at, so we're right now, it's March of 25.
Were you running for the whole joint, or you ran just for a unit, or?
I ran for the entire institution. At that point, I was running at the institution level.
Right.
And I had to put together my funding request, which became part of the institution's funding request, which then goes up the chain of command region, the central office. But you would be looking at folks. So if I was running my roster now to plan for FY26, right, I'm looking at folks releasing between October of 25 and September of 26. Add another year onto that for conditional release dates. Now you're talking September of 27. Add 2 more years or more for conditional halfway house. We're talking funding, looking at releases out that would be, in terms of the release date, potentially 2029 now.
Yeah.
Like it boggles the mind how many more individuals got pulled into that budget information that nobody had.
Isn't that crazy? Now, let's say you're at a, let's compare a low. Let's say you're at, this is hypothetical. Let's say you're at Big Spring Low versus USP Lee. It has, and USP Lee is a camp, right? But that penitentiary really isn't going to run, right? I mean, they're going to have a lot more people staying in there a lot longer, right? So you're not in a USP or a medium. You're not going to have
and this is a ballpark kind of figure. We always looked at whatever our camp population was, we were going to turn over at least that number. So you got 125 satellite camp. It may not be the same 125, but realistically, you were going to take in 125, you were going to release 125.
100%.
And that's just how it works. Yeah. So that's 125, but when I'm also paired with that, a 1,500 bed penitentiary, which prior to the Second Chance Act, if you had 25 halfway house releases in a year out of a penitentiary prior to the Second Chance Act, you were busy. Because, you know, and this is going to sound harsh, but it was like you got a bus ticket, $50, and good luck. And very few individuals who were releasing from a penitentiary got halfway house. Why? Because they were seen to be a community threat. 2007 rolls around, everybody all of a sudden realizes, huh, maybe if someone does 20 or 30 or 35 years in prison, dumping them into the community with $50 and a bus ticket probably isn't the smartest decision. So right. That's where the Second Chance Act really opened up halfway house placements for those individuals at the medium and the high security facilities, which was a phenomenal increase. Like I said, if I had had 25 halfway house releases from the penitentiary in a year, that was a busy year. That was, we were rocking it. We were busy. You know, that comes along and we go from realistically 15, 20, like I said, on a busy year, 25 to 200 releases a year. Because there's a lot of folks, people think of penitentiaries as having all of these folks with life sentences and 20 and 30 years. But you can have time left on, you can be a short timer, but just that serious an offense, that bad of a background, that much misconduct. I mean, you know, add the numbers up. You can still be in a penitentiary, or you're a violator. You know, something like 45-50% of those high risk type individuals, right, are coming back to prison. How quickly they come back is a question, whether it's less than a year, in a year, but you'd have them come back in. And I may have someone with an SRT violation 10 months, 12 months, 15 months.
So and was that their parent? Was that their parent institution?
Back to there. Sometimes it was their parent institution. Sometimes, depending on what the violation, maybe they released from a medium, got an SRT violation, picked up a new criminal charge. Maybe it was something low level. Maybe it was just a small drug offense. So they come back with a 42-month sentence.
Gotcha.
Yeah. So,
well, yeah. Anyway, I mean, not, you know, it's not our everyday case that coming out of there, but it is worth to mention. So, First Step Act, Second Chance Act. So, any other ways that those two don't play well together, as you famously say?
Yes, absolutely. Home confinement, just horribly difficult to manage. And this really was an oversight of the Congress. You and I have talked about it. If there was one thing Congress could do like today is eliminate the Second Chance Act restriction. So under the Second Chance Act, everyone is eligible for up to 12 months of halfway house, eligible, not guaranteed.
Correct.
And within that 12 months, you can receive 10% or 180 days, whichever is less, in home confinement. So the maximum amount of home confinement is 180 days. But for a lot of our, and we see this all the time, we explain it, a lot of our clients. So you've got a three-year sentence. Three-year sentence, you're getting good conduct time, 54 days times three. Mm-hmm. You probably don't have any jail credit. You're self-reporting, you're voluntary surrendering directly to a camp. You're going to start earning time credits just as soon as you get yourself settled, right? See it all the time. You're getting your good conduct time. You're getting your FSA time. You will not have enough time after they calculate off your good conduct time to earn a full 365 days. So you are earning credits. You're earning programming days. You're accumulating those days to earn credits right up to your release, both in the institution and in halfway house, right? But your placement is under the Second Chance Act. That's another, it's kind of, place of confusion for folks because they'll tell us, but I'm releasing under the First Step Act. Yes, you are releasing under the First Step Act, but you're going to halfway house under the Second Chance Act. So now they've got this limitation of 10% of their sentence, right? So if you only have a 36-month sentence.
10% of the original sentence or 10% of what sentence?
10% of your sentence. So you get 36 months from the court, you're getting 10%. So about 3.5 months, right?
Gotcha.
So that time, though, is not attached to your conditional date. It's attached to your official date, your projected release date, the date that is your good conduct time and your earned credit, not your unearned credit. So then every single month, you're earning 10 days, then eventually you're earning 15 days, and your release date is moving every single month, right? Well, guess what? Your home confinement eligibility date is also moving by that 10 or 15 days. So when you get a halfway house placement recommendation, right, of 90 to 120 days, and maybe you get it, maybe you don't, that 90 days of home confinement isn't even close because it's based on your current release date, not what your release date will be once you burn those credits up to the day you've left. Again, it's another problem with the law from just an administrative management perspective is what's happening is, one, folks are going to halfway house that in many cases could go to direct home confinement if the restriction wasn't there, right?
Right.
And two, it's this whole issue of they're continuing to earn credit every day. Like, it's continuing right up to them when they release. So their home confinement is literally moving. So we'll see individuals with like a 60-day home confinement eligibility, but the earliest they're going to get to use it, they may have 6 weeks left. We've even seen some less than that where they come up and they're only going to be getting like 18 days of home confinement.
Right. Which, by the way, to my knowledge, they haven't pushed the button for the February credits yet in March, right?
Yeah.
I know they did that one button push.
They did it twice. We're still getting some math. What we're hearing is because of the issue with the conditional calculator, which is not an issue that it's not working. It does work, but because of this weirdness of you can't get the days, you can't get your credit until you have your accumulation of 30 days. Well, if your 30 days happens on the 12th of the month, but we're not updating until they aren't updating until the end of the month, you're not getting the benefit until the end of the month, even if your release date was on the 21st, the 20th, the 19th. So what they're looking at for at least the community days, for the folks in the community, is starting to run that calculator more frequently. The reason they don't do it with the entire population, it's too big. It takes over 24 hours to run through the system, which is why they do it on the weekend. But for the folks in the community, that population is much smaller. So what they are looking at doing is moving to more frequent updates. We have not heard if it's going to be biweekly or weekly, but what it will do for folks in the community is the likelihood of them actually releasing on their conditional date becomes higher because, again, in most cases, to get that conditional date, they need the calculator to run more frequently.
So,
and I think they're going to have to. They were exploring doing that for the folks in the institution as well.
Yeah.
The problem is the size of the run they can do. I think they're looking at, and the reason they're looking at it is we are seeing more folks in the community that aren't getting the second chance. The beds just aren't there. Their needs are minimal. Second Chance Act is not about releasing early from prison, right? It's about transitional services. So those folks with lower needs and the budget, coupled with the bed space. And I think we're going to continue to see that. So I think they're going to have to do something for the folks.
I think you need to say that again. Second Chance Act isn't about getting out early. It's about how your community transition is going to be administered.
Right. It's about transitional needs. It was never designed to be a way to get out of prison early. If you take these folks with short sentences, minimal intact families, minimal release issues, and now we couple that with bed space crunches, budget crunches, and the fact that they have to prioritize the FSA placements over the Second Chance Act placements.
Okay.
Which that means for our friends out there who are looking at a Second Chance Act placement, the next 6 months are going to be rough.
It's going to be kind of rough, particularly those people that had shorter sentences that all of their FSA time went toward the reduction of their sentence. nothing toward halfway house. So the only thing that they can do, the case managers can do at the halfway house, is look at the five-factor review and the Second Chance Act and try to squeeze and eke out as much placement as possible. And that's the frustration with a lot of our clients and their families. They're you know, because even as we said again, I'll say it again every week, even a year ago, man, we had those two brothers get a year RRC on a fairly short sentence. We were stupefied. You're like, oh my God, really? And so how, and, but they just happened to have the beds then. And then all of a sudden, like a light switch, a lot of this stuff, you know, went down. We talk about 1 day placements in Tampa, 0 day placements in Mid-Atlantic, Baltimore. I mean, so we talk about how some of these areas are just packed to the gills for quite a while. And it's really, really tough to get a thing. And so that's where folks, you know, want to blame. I mean, look, there's people, I mean, there's stuff that happened. Yeah, there's no bed. Why there's no bed? Because, you know, budget, and they need to do these contracts. They need to get more beds to allow for these, you know, for First Step Act and Second Chance. They need more beds. But what's hamstringing them is
even if beds are available because of this budget crunch that's going on, and the fact that they have the conditional FSA placement calculator pulled all these FSA cases forward.
Right.
You know, they've even, you know, I'm hearing rumors they're even looking at some of the folks that haven't moved yet. Is their dates being modified? And that's, you know, really frustrating. You finally broke through, you got the hurdle, and you got a date. And now
what date's gonna get modified? Which date gets modified?
The designation date. If they have a case, if because of what we're dealing with the FSA and the lack of discretion and the combination of the lack of discretion coupled with these extraordinarily long FSA placements, which arguably are a bad thing. I know probably not everyone would agree with that, but, you know, halfway house home confinement was not designed to be in the community for 2 and 3 years. That just wasn't the point of it.
Right. And you know what? You came in this last year, but I had so many CARES Act people, so many CARES Act guys and gals that were clients of mine that were sick and tired of being on home confinement for 2, 3, and 4 years, right? Since COVID. And they're just pulling their hair out. I'm like, bro, you're out of the joint. You're living at home. I got to get off this monitor. God, it's driving me nuts, you know? And so.
Can't do anything. Can't plan for family vacations. You're almost there, but you're not. I like to jokingly say it's like being 8.5 months pregnant. You are ready for the next phase. You are over being pregnant. And any woman out there who's had a baby knows exactly what I'm talking about. By 8.5 months, you are done. You're like, let's move it along now.
That is a great point. I like that, being 8.5 months pregnant. That's awesome.
So, and every woman out there knows exactly what I'm talking about. But you're right. And it just was never designed for that. You know, if I could wave my magic wand and kind of change how the credits were applied, I would rather see the opportunity to earn more credits toward early release and limit home confinement and halfway house. This idea of, you know, we've got folks right now, clients of ours that have 26 month halfway house placement. That's a lot of time. Even if they transfer out of the halfway house within the next month, you know, within those weeks or month after getting there.
But those were based on FSA days. So it was a combo pack, right?
No, the one I'm thinking about was all FSA.
Oh, was that just a long sentence then? The guy had been in there.
He was at the tail end. He's at the tail end of the sentence, and he is benefiting from that conditional calculator that says, okay, when we move together, this is when it's going to be.
And that's his FSA conditional placement date.
Yes.
And he's looking at, he or she's looking at 2 years.
26 months of halfway pre-release placement, halfway house or home confinement. So that is what is killing the budget. Because again, prior to FSA, If we go in the Wayback Machine, the average placement was 120 to 150 days.
Yeah.
Across the board. That was everyone who was getting 7, 8, 9 months on Second Chance Act, down to folks getting nothing. It was averaging 120 to 150 days. Get in, get a job, get several paychecks under your belt, have money to find a place to live if you don't have a place to go.
Right. Right. Well, you know, once again, folks, see how complicated this is. And, you know, and I have to read every day, and I have to ask Susan questions every day. And I have to think this through, you know, like, okay, the first bucket is the sentence for FSA. The second bucket is RRC placement. And the third bucket, if there is one, is invisible. We used to say about probation or whatever, but is there a third bucket?
No, there isn't. Congress did not give a door number three, which again, you know, if we, and just for a moment, I'll pick on the courts for a moment. You know, early on, there was a court case that the court ordered that the extra credit, because by the time the credit rolled out and there was some retroactive application of credit, right? An individual had more credits remaining, or more credits that he earned versus the remaining time to serve. And the judge turned around and ordered that be applied to supervised release, which is not in the law. Like, I don't know where he gleaned that out of the law, but the judge did. And I can't tell you how many cases I have seen since then cite that case, which is pretty much been uniformly, that decision was pretty much uniformly rejected by other courts, even though it was appealed by the Bureau. So,
case in point, I got to bring this up. Ladies and gentlemen, another case in point, especially all the out there in these prison yards. Hey, there's this lawsuit, Smith versus Jones, where the inmate was on in transit status or holdover or pretrial at a FDC or a U.S. Marshals prisoner somewhere. And he got all that time credited toward his FSA. That's not what the law says. You have to be an institution.
And when we look at these orders, and we haven't seen all of them, but we do look at them, the several of the recent orders, and by recent I mean the post-Loper case, so when Chevron disappeared, the cases haven't ordered the Bureau apply the credit. The cases ordered that the Bureau look at those contested periods, and if the individual was involved in programming, matching the definition of successful programming, that being an important caveat, then the Bureau should recalculate accordingly. Well, guess what? What is the Bureau, and the courts do recognize that it's the Bureau's judgment to say, was successful programming accomplished, right? And that is within the Loper decision, post-Chevron era, right? Well, one of the things is the program has to be an evidence-based recidivism-reducing program, an EBVR, or a productive activity. It has to be a program for a verified need. So if you don't have a need in that particular area, but you went and did it anyway because it was the program that was available while you were sitting in one of the detention centers and you were, you know, thinking this was going to help, but you didn't have a need, well, the program has to be based on a need. And then staff assign the programming. So when we're talking about folks in detention centers, in holdover, they've been sentenced, may or may not have been designated, haven't moved to a Bureau facility. They haven't had folks,
And folks, especially everybody in touch with us, if you know that court case, I've looked in PACER. I can't find it, right? So if you know this court case that everybody's talking about where the person was granted that time toward their FSA, please contact us through direct message or our Facebook group.
Yeah. Because the ones we're seeing, when we actually look at the order, it's not, it's that inmate.com, right? It's It's the rumor mill. Right. And when we actually look at the case itself, the judge did not order credit be given. The judge ordered that the Bureau of reevaluate the contested
theories.
So for someone who's in martial status, whether they're say they're in that holdover before designation or they're pending movement, they haven't had a risk and need assessment. No needs have been identified. Therefore, programming that was done was not based on identified needs. Programming was based on passing the time, which is not a bad thing. Passing the time is good, but the programming has to be on the need. So
like here in Texas, if you're at Mansfield, at the federal pod in Mansfield or Limestone County in the U.S. Marshals cell, I mean, you're sitting there. And I get it. You want your time to count, right? I mean, you're serving federal time and it counts towards your, you know, good conduct time release. Make no mistake about it. It does count. But the way these other laws are written, it can't count.
And if you're sitting in any county jail, any marshal facility, any non-bureau facility, any programming you might take is not an EBBR or productive activity, because EBBR and productive activities are specifically approved.
But you could be in an FDC or an MDC, which is a bureau facility. But however,
you could be. So you might be taking an EBBR or a productive activity, but if it's not based on an identified need, then it's just a program to pass time. It doesn't count under the FSA programming. The third issue, and we see this, is people just, I'm going to sign up for everything. I'm going to put a cop out in for everything. I'm going to take everything on the sun. Well, if you look at the language of the law, it actually says that bureau staff are assigning programming to you based on need. When does that usually happen? In team. It can happen separate from team, but most of the time, you know, it may be that your team has said, hey, you meet this need. We want you to go see psychology. And then psychology actually puts you on a waiting list for that class.
And that's good. If you're on the waiting list, you're good.
You've been assigned to that program based on an identified need. But if you're just submitting cop-outs and taking stuff on your own just because you're trying to like grab up as many programming days as you think, you're literally not doing anything. And that's harsh, other than you're passing your time. Now there are some exceptions. Let me holler first. I'm sorry. I didn't mean to interrupt you. If you're working on your GED, you are in pretrial, you're in holdover status, you do not have a high school diploma, you're working on your GED. Completion of that counts toward your pattern score. Your pattern score, and that makes a difference when you get to your facility, they do your initial pattern score, because if you're low or medium or high, you're earning credit, but you're not applying credit. You have to be at a low or a minimum. So if you can finish your GED before you even walk in the door at your designated facility and get team taken care of, you're getting points. You're getting those extra points. If you get that taken care of before you're designated, right, and you complete it, you're helping your designation, you're helping your security level. So that's one caveat where doing that in pretrial is a good thing.
So long story short, if I'm given something from my case manager, so my first team, I'll have something from my case manager saying, these are the classes that the BOP wants me to take based on my needs. And inmate Bruce will have this sheet that I can keep with me.
If the case manager doesn't give it to them, they need to ask for it. They should get a copy of their team sheet, their risk assessment, their pattern, and their time credit worksheet, which won't exist at their first team because they're doing their assessments at their second team. They'll be able to get the time credit worksheet.
Right. But they'll get this on the first team. Whoops.
Yep.
Okay. So that's, but see, folks, a lot of folks, and kind of sort of, I was under that. God, I kind of had a misconception. Like, just make sure you sign up. You're engaged in programming. You know what I mean? This and that. I never thought to say, hey, the first thing you do is make sure that you look at the programming that was indicated on your your sheet from the case manager based on your needs. Take those for sure. If there's time for other stuff, of course, take it, but make sure you get those. And now, haven't we had a couple of cases where we kind of did some stuff with psychology and they had to reset the date, or have we had anything like that? Yeah.
So we had a couple of different things. So one of the things I want to say though, with the programming is what we don't want is folks to go, well, I know they recommended this, but I don't want to do this. I'm going to do that. If you're recommended and you tell the program provider, you tell the psychologist or the education person or whoever is the facilitator of the program, no, I don't want to do that. And you're placed in decline status.
Right.
Taking other stuff doesn't matter.
Right. I mean, if I'm the inmate and it says for me and my kids are grown, Mr. Cameron, you've got to take parenting. Guess what Mr. Cameron's going to do? Take parenting. Let's say I have a fixed income or whatever. I'm retiree. I'm going to go out. I'm okay. Ms. Cameron, you need to take financial management. Guess what I'm taking? Financial management, right? So I'm going to do what this says so I can get out and get the most credit possible, even if it doesn't necessarily apply to me or my station in life. I mean, I understand that some of this stuff makes sense for folks. Some of it doesn't.
And some are ready to acknowledge that they need to be in a given program. When I was still working and I was doing the training, conducting training and providing stuff out there, I used to talk about, well, you do the needs assessment for anger and hostility, and it comes back that you got anger issues. And now you're sitting in team and telling this person on your caseload, hey, we're recommending anger management. And the response back is, I don't have any anger issues. I don't want that class. And I used to tell the case managers and case management coordinators, at that point, you need to counsel them that the needs assessment says you do. Yeah. And if you decline, you are opting out and you're not going to get any time credits. If they still don't want to acknowledge their anger issues and they want to decline, it's their business. But some folks aren't ready to kind of acknowledge there's a problem in a given area.
Yeah. And so anger management, I'd be taking that class anyway. Some of y'all know that. And then like antisocial peers. I don't leave the house. So I drive on the freeway. That's some antisocial peers on the freeway. Okay. But you know what?
So we asked the question about the psychology and person. Yes. So we had a client that one of their needs assessments indicated that they had declined to participate. They refused to participate in the assessment. Well, that assessment isn't a standalone assessment. It's actually embedded within another intake sheet. And, it was a matter of the piece of paper wasn't in the stack that he was given when he walked in the door and was sitting in an R&D holding cell filling out 2,700 pieces of paper. And it was missed. And we caught it. And, we reached out to the family and, go over to psychology today. And he did. He took care of it. But they went and entered the day that they took the assessment and didn't backdate it to the beginning. Now we're waiting to hear. We've given some ideas about how to respond and how to request that through the administrative remedy process. That takes time. Yes, the correction can be made. And some folks are like, oh, our bad, the paper wasn't there. And they key it incorrectly. And in this case, they just keyed it for the current day, which was not right.
And this is just a clear example of how particularly Susan's case management expertise, hey, go to psychology. Do you understand? People could have gotten lost in some other shuffle. We're going to go ahead and file with the courts, or we're going to start DP-8s. And start going down these tangential things. It would never get fixed. Another month goes by. Nothing. See what I mean? But this, and we've had other cases like this where it just gets fixed and you go to the right person and And sometimes if we have to send an assistance email, we'll do that, but to get the ball over the net. So that's just another great example of how, you know, consulting like this is so beneficial because, you know, had we not been there, and particularly Susan, you know, knowing nearly, not nearly, every facet of case management. And I say that seriously. I'm just dead serious. I don't know that stuff. I'm the other guy with the programs. And
the problem is the law is unduly complicated. It doesn't need to be this complicated, and it is. And because it's so complicated, it required the use of technology in order to implement and have everyone apply. And because of that, these little things happen. You know, if you miss a piece of paper in a stack of a dozen sheets of paper, and then those pieces of paper get subdivided into little stacks and sends off to a department, they're keying stuff in, unless they catch that they had 10 people come in this week, but they only had 9 intake screening forms and realize, hey, we're short one. I mean, if it's because of the complicated nature and the way Congress wrote different stuff that in some cases is contradictory within the law itself. But then you have the implementation side, which is complicated. But then there's also the training of staff and the explaining it to the incarcerated population. Like, and then it keeps changing, as we've talked about. And it's changing because we have a change in administration who has different ideas about what they want and which is different than the last guy wanted. And now the Bureau is jumping through hoops to try to comply with that. At the same time, train their people totally different and then pass that information, new, totally different information out to the population.
Incredible. Well, we're about ready to wind it down. See how fast these shows go. My God, we just barely got off the ground. I had another RDAP versus FSA for next week.
We'll talk about that. RDAP, animal.
That's a whole show there. We won't do that right now. That's a teaser, though, for you to tune in next time and have that discussion. Real quick, folks, if you're not sentenced yet or you're going through the pre-sentence report phase of your federal to be experience, you need to buy this green book right here. Okay. Now, if you're already incarcerated and you want to understand what's going on with your First Step Act, you need this book right here. If you're going from a medium to a low and you're finally going to be earning FS, hey, get this book right here. Have your loved ones send these in to the prison from Amazon, Unlocking Federal Time Credits and Unlocking Federal Prison Designation. 2 invaluable resources. We had some lawyers this week thank us profusely for this book here. They're taking on federal cases, and they really understood what the heck was going on and why to make amendments and certain objections to the PSR if something isn't correct, because it can have costly consequences. Because this, the PSR is what the Bureau goes by. It's like gospel. It's like,
and I'm going to put in an added plug for that one, because that was something I saw as a case management coordinator all the time. If I heard once, I heard it weekly, but my lawyer said,
Here we are again, National Association of Criminal Defense Lawyers, a champion. Oh, there we are with the blue book. We'll be in there at the green book. Hopefully we're going to be published in there with a big fat article, op-ed or article explaining that. Well, folks, thanks again for tuning in to Around the Block here. Federal Prison Authority presents Around the Block. Hopefully soon we're going to be on iHeartRadio. I'm working on that. I've been working diligently. It's only our second podcast, but I think we're going to get out there on Apple Podcasts and iHeart real soon. I'll let you know that stuff doesn't happen overnight. And come by our federalprisonauthority.com, our website. Another YouTube channel is First Step Act. And it's the one they'll say that Bruce Cameron and Susan. It's actually our last podcast. I think it'll be the first video on the line. And of course, our Facebook group, early release from Federal
Prison. Questions that you want us to answer on the podcast, post them into the Facebook chat so that we can answer your questions.
Or
email us.
PM me or Sue, but PM me if you want. And then I'll write it down diligently because I want to answer your questions.
Yeah.
That makes this all more meaningful. what we're saying is meaningful, but certainly if people have focused questions, we'd be more than glad. Maybe we'll take calls one day. I'll talk to Sam and we'll see if we can take some callers and make sure we have the 7 second delay. Just kidding. I don't think we do that, but we'll do that as well. Okay, everybody. Well, have a great week and stay good. And we'll see you next time on Around the Block. Take care, everybody.
Bye-bye.
You're listening to Federal Prison Authority Presents Around the Block with Bruce Cameron and Susan Giddings, only on LA Talk Radio.